IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. A lot of us might be familiar with terms like the G7 or the G2 or the G4 or the G8. And we might increasingly also be familiar with a grouping such as the Quad, which is a security dialogue between the US, Australia, Japan, and India. But there are new kinds of alignments that are emerging in the world today, which have a totally different agenda than security and just broad economic collaboration. And these are coalitions based around technology. So you have groupings like the T10, the T12, and so on that are being talked about. What we're going to do over the course of this podcast is try to understand what the potential is for technology groupings, what these groupings aim to achieve, and where India's stance might be as far as these technology groupings are, and how these might actually end up serving the national interest. So welcome, Rohan and Pranay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello.
So let's begin by starting to understand what a technology collaboration is. Rohan, can you tell us a little bit about these T12s and other groupings that are being talked about today?
Yeah, sure. So I want to start by plugging in an op-ed that Pranay and I wrote for Hindustan Times. I think it's a cardinal rule at Takshashila, or specifically my podcast, that I do something. So when we were writing this op-ed, we started by saying T12 is the new G8 and so on. So it seemed like a bit of an alphabet soup to me. But if you basically go into these alliances, T12, T10, D10 and so on, the basic idea is that a bunch of democracies get together to counter the rise of China in technology. So for example, I think we can put the readings in the show notes, but so for example, 8 countries recently formed an alliance to counter China as far as 5G was concerned. Right. And so those 8 countries are US, Germany, UK, Japan, Australia, Canada, Sweden, Norway, and members of the European Parliament. And that's a pretty significant cross-section of democracies that want to counter China on 5G. There's also this thing called a clean network initiative, if I'm not wrong. Mike Pompeo said that in a press release. I think Manoj referred me to that. That specifically, the whole page basically talks about having a bunch of democracies follow a certain standard for critical industries like semiconductors, for 5G, for data, that is opposed to the Chinese standard. And they're pretty vocal about suppressing the rise of China in technology. So all of this clean water, clean network initiative, T10, T12, D10, are basically initiatives that want to define a new standard of technology that democracies generally are comfortable with, and that is opposed to how China approaches tech and policy.
Okay, so that's something that I want to kind of like quiz you about a little bit, Rohan, because I find it interesting that you say that the reason why these countries are coming together is because they're democracies. So is the idea that China and Chinese technology is somehow such a terrible threat to their values that they are banding up together to stop that? Because, I mean, let's be perfectly frank. I mean, the US doesn't exactly have the best record when it comes to respecting the data privacy. And so I find it a little odd that we say that these are democracies that are coming together, because I think personally that you could also interpret as a kind of national interest-driven calculation to kind of help Western technology firms compete with Chinese firms, which tend to have much, much cheaper products on a more even footing. What do you think?
I would argue that there is some truth to two statements. The first one is that there is some element of national interest involved in countering China because they don't want to compete with the Chinese on some fronts. And the other sort of, darker point is that there is some concern around the areas that the Chinese are targeting as far as tech is concerned. So there are genuine concerns about Huawei installing 5G networks in your country, for example. And there are also genuine concerns around the Chinese. I think they said it themselves. Chinese want to be self-reliant as far as semiconductors are concerned. So both of these 5G and semiconductors are pretty foundational technologies that will basically form the highways on which the rest of your tech is built. And if someone else is is building those highways for you, then that is a strategic thing that you need to consider and basically try to avoid. So little column A, little column B to that.
Yeah, if I may just add to that, I agree with Rohan. So Anirudh, one thing is in international politics, there's nothing which you can take away from the angle of power, right? It is definitely why this is happening now, because Chinese companies are getting bigger and sometimes better than many other companies. So it is scaring many other countries into action, right? So that there's definitely one angle in that. And the whole idea backdrop to this is that one major angle of power of a nation state going ahead will be its technological supremacy or its ability to harness technologies for various kinds of goals, right? And that's why I guess it is many countries have been sprung into action because what China has done, and it has done reasonably well on a lot of technologies and emerging technologies, right? So that is one angle. But at the same time, let us not be under any doubt that China and US are on equal footing when it comes to protection of citizen rights or anything. I mean, you've looked at how social credit systems have been operating in China. We've looked at how there is now backlash within China on the usage of face cameras and how they have been tracking activities of citizens. So all those things exist. Secondly, on Huawei's point, which Rohan mentioned, there is very little separation between the state and these companies. That's much more so in China than in many other countries. So that's why these companies, if they do something wrong, they will do something wrong even in the US, even in India, maybe even in Europe as well. But these will, we depend on our law and security agencies to bring those to the public domain, on our judiciary to bring those out and to protect individual rights. But that is not the same which will happen in China. So there is clearly a difference, but there is also the angle of power which is having a role to play in this calculation.
Okay, fair enough. So to try and summarize this from the Indian perspective, right? India needs high-tech stuff in order to grow its economy. It needs to have cheaper consumer electronics. It needs to have better connectivity through 5G or whatever. And the question is really, how do we ensure that India has that available? One option is to go for China. If you were to go for China, then there's always the risk that Huawei is going to do something dangerous with our citizens' data, and that we would have no recourse if that were to happen. Alternatively, we could try to go with Western companies, which even though they might certainly be collecting information in a lot of unethical ways, will at least be under a kind of a legal system that India can still work with, and with governments that India can still work with to kind of seek redress if the worst should happen. I assume that summarizes your arguments correctly.
Yeah, I would just add that it's not just about access to these technologies, it is about co-development as well. A lot of these things are in progress, like standards are being defined about how AI can be used. People are thinking about standards for a bunch of these emerging technologies, right? So it is important for India to also be in a formation where it can mold these standards to the benefit of Indians, right? That role is also important. It's not just that India is a taker here. India is also a giver, right? In terms of human capital, in terms of people who can create these standards, contribute to the research and development. So I think the agenda is broader, and it is more significant than just getting access to technology A or technology B.
Fair enough. So, and I think that really is the meat of the op-ed that you guys have written, right? The question of how India can actually co-develop some of these technologies. So let's get into the details of how you guys think this could potentially work. You pointed out that when it comes to the Quad, when it comes to US, Japan, Australia, and India, there are a lot of complementarities in the technology space, and that potentially working together can help all of these countries achieve better outcomes. So let's go through them one by one. First, the US. What does the US bring to the table in terms of a potential co-development sort of deal?
Anirudh, even before we go into that, I just wanted to bring this point, why Quad, right? I think that is one important thing to discuss. Given that there are so many of these formations, why don't we tag along with one of these formations and then just go on those lines, right? So what the point that we are making is, even amongst democracies, there are very divergent views on what technology governance, technology policy should look like, right? I mean, just take the example of privacy, for example. What the EU's understanding of privacy is very different from what the US understands it or what India understands it, right? So, for example, you have EU, which takes a very regulation-heavy approach, and it is centered on protecting users' data. US is traditionally preferred a less restrictive approach, which allows technology companies to gain scale. And here in India, we have lots of debates about data localization and trying to attract foreign companies, even while we also want to build our own national champions, right? So you clearly see, even amongst democracies, there is a huge array of possibilities on these issues itself. So the point that we are trying to make is that, given that you have so many divergent approaches, if you start grounds up with a new formation, you are going to have a really tough time to come on to agreement with even these fundamental issues, right? How do you govern competition in digital economy, technology governance, et cetera, right? How do you govern Amazon and platforms, all that? So our point is that not to get muddled up in these, the better approach for India would be to use an existing politico-military arrangement to actually plug in technology as one of the extra things that that arrangement does, right? So in that sense, we were thinking that Quad is a good nucleus of countries to start off with. It doesn't mean that it has to be just the Quad countries, but given that Quad countries have a very specific goal in mind, right? The reason why Quad has finally come to fruition in whatever way it has now is because the goal is clear that China's dangers that it poses in the Indo-Pacific need to be resisted. So that goal is pretty much clear. And once you have that goal clear in a multilateral arrangement, negotiations on the finer issues of what should we do on digital economy, which country should give up and which country should gain, all those reciprocal arrangements work much better if you have a final end goal in mind. And that's why we thought Quad is a good starting point, and it can involve many more countries going ahead as well. So that's what a caveat that I wanted to add. Rohan, why don't you start with what are the advantages that US has?
Yeah, plus one to everything Pranay said in general. And so the thing with the US is that it's actually a pretty big powerhouse when it comes to designing semiconductors. For example, let's talk about the software that's used to design semiconductors. These are very specialized pieces of software called EDA tools. Correct me if I'm wrong, Pranay, but I think this electronic design automation tools, I think I got that right. And the major, it's a very concentrated space. And the major companies in that space are American. So there's Cadence Systems, there's Mentor, and there's one more whose name I forget. So one of them was bought by Germany, but it's still based in the US. The other two are still American. And so it's quite a sort of dominant position that the US is in semiconductor designing, right? And a lot of semiconductor design also just happens in the US. And so you might have contract manufacturers like TSMC or Samsung, but the designs that are sent to these manufacturers originate in the US. And so that's a pretty strong position in the value chain to be in. So that's the comparative advantage America has. And that's why it's a pretty valuable member in the Quad to focus on.
So I think one of the arguments that you guys are making in your op-ed is also that India does pretty well as far as semiconductor design goes, right?
Yes. Okay. Before that, Anirudh, one more point that I wanted to make is that we just discussed semiconductors as a starting point even within the Quad for a couple of reasons. Okay, so again, like instead of trying to debate about digital economy, competition, privacy, why not start small about one particular issue and then grow the collaboration from there? That was our point. And semiconductors, why? Because semiconductors semiconductors sort of underlie all critical technologies, you know, whether you have advancements in computing or artificial intelligence, 5G or space technology, whatever, you will need rapid improvements in semiconductor technology to make such devices faster and cheaper. So that will still remain as we go ahead, right? And second, semiconductors are the most globalized high-value supply chain. There are very few, like Rohan mentioned, there are just two or three companies in each stage of the semiconductor supply chain which can act as bottlenecks. All right, so there is no one country which can be completely self-sufficient in semiconductors, and as China is finding out, it's quite difficult. So the industry is spread all across the world. So even if US is in the dominant position here, it's not as if US can do everything in semiconductors. Even today, most of US semiconductor manufacturing has actually shifted into Taiwan, for example. So the idea is that this is a good sector to collaborate. Four countries can do what one country, even if it is the most powerful country in the world, can't do on its own. And that's why we thought this is a good starting point.
Okay, fair enough. I kind of see there's almost like a concordance in terms of the principle that you used to argue for the Quad, saying that, okay, you know, there's this limited security thing that we all agree on, so let's use that to build out something greater. And similarly, there's this limited thing, namely semiconductor design and manufacturing, that all of us have complementary strengths on. So let's tack that onto the agreement and kind of grow it from there, right?
Right, absolutely.
So let's just come back to the thread that we were on originally then. Yeah. So what about India? What does India bring to the table in all of this?
Yeah, so India is really... let's divide the semiconductor supply chain into a few stages, right? So first you have the R&D and design stage, then you have a manufacturing stage, and then finally you have the assembly and testing phase, and you also distribute semiconductors to the final original equipment manufacturers. So you have these some four or five stages that you can think of. Now, Rohan already mentioned that four out of the top 10 fabless companies, that is companies which just do exclusively the design, are American. And even the software, which are very specialized software, which is used to do this design, is also owned by American companies, right? So that is one section. Now, coming to India, this design stage is also a very human capital intensive stage. Basically, you just need a large number of well-qualified engineers in electronics, in material sciences, etc., to participate in this stage, right? So that's where India has an advantage. And we had some stats, like, for example, the IESA, which is the Indian Electronic Semiconductor Association, had done a survey, and they said that nearly 3,000 chips are designed in India every year. And in fact, most of the top foreign semiconductor companies have their R&D or design centers in India. So you have, whether it is Qualcomm, whether it is Texas Instruments, Intel, Samsung, all these companies do have some base in India with a large number of engineers skilled enough to do R&D and especially design of semiconductors. So that's where we think there is definitely an advantage. Now, coming to the last stage, which would be finally distribution and then putting those semiconductors onto printed circuit boards, assembly, and then, you know, assembling it into a final product like a phone. There again, it's a very labor intensive sector, and you would require large number of people who can on an assembly line who can do this work, right? Now, here again, India is not the best in the world, definitely, but India has made some beginnings. So you have Foxconn, which recently announced its intent to invest in India. You also have Samsung building its largest mobile phone manufacturing plant. So those things are also where India has a sort of advantage. So anything related to human capital is something that India can take advantage of.
Okay, so that's interesting. I remember that in our Tank Scrub, which is our weekly meeting that happens every Thursday, Rohan talked a little bit about where the human capital that is designing all these chips in the US is coming from. And one thing that really stuck with me was the fact that a huge number of them are actually Indian graduates. So you have people who've done their bachelor's in India and who are going to the US to get their master's or PhD and then end up in working in these major like semiconductor chip design firms. Which brings me to another question, right? So clearly India is doing something right if there are so many kind of design companies in India. But the fact that so many Indian graduates are going to the USA in order to get the qualification and end up getting a job seems to point to something that India isn't doing that well, and that is namely actually educating this enormous pool of human capital that we have. So how do you guys think that bridge that gap can be bridged? Do you think that it's something that potential collaboration with the US could look at in terms of like improving India's human capital as well, so India can grow as a semiconductor designer?
That's a good question, Anirudh, but we have to understand why human capital or people, engineers are going to the US instead of India. I think the reason for that is more structural. The fact that we have an ecosystem which exists in the US for semiconductors, and it doesn't exist in India for a variety of reasons, right? Some of them are just the fact that we are not able to build big businesses. There are labor issues, there are contractual issues, legal issues. So those are a broader set of issues that need to be fixed. Also the demand side, right? You also need in a semiconductor ecosystem finally to be able to produce products. The original equipment manufacturer should be in the same country, but we don't have that as of now. So given those constraints, it is fine if there are a lot of Indians who are going to the US and they are leading providers for human capital in the US semiconductor industry. So I think the advantage again is, as we said, that no one country can build this semiconductor industry on its own. So if we have these arrangements, the advantage is that US, India, Japan and Australia will be able to take advantage of all of their different strengths and come together.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point, Pranay. One thing I would like to add here is, and sorry about the humble plug, guys, but in the newsletter that I started today, which is called Hand Me the Paper, I talk about the paper in TankScrub, and the industry in the US has pretty strong network effects, which means that if you are in a particular ecosystem in the semiconductor industry, you're likely to stay there, and it's very hard to make sure that human capital that goes from India to the US can come back from US to India. And as you'll see, I think we can link the paper in the show notes, but most of the people who are moving from India to the US are moving for a master's degree or a PhD, and with the explicit goal of staying there. So I don't think reversing that is going to be an easy phenomena, but I'm not an expert in migration policy. So maybe we can refer that to someone else who is. And one thing that I also would like to talk about here is Japan, which is another member of the Quad, which is pretty useful when it comes to semiconductor manufacturing equipment. And there are three elements that I wanted to discuss. Pranay, you please add whatever, whenever you think it's right. But the three things that Japan does really well at is manufacturing and shipping silicon wafers. The second thing that is manufacturing photoresists, and finally manufacturing etching gas. So etching gas basically is the gas that's used to remove unwanted stuff from the chip. It's a pretty crucial step in the manufacturing process. Wafers, of course, are foundational to sort of just what the chip should be made on. And so wafers are, of course, how do you say this? Indispensable. And of course, the photoresists are useful in the etching process as well. So, and these are areas where Japan has been pretty dominant. It's been dominant because it's told South Korea that it's not going to ship etching gas. I think that happened a few years ago, and South Korea basically had to come up with its own industry. And so, a pretty useful advantage to have there in the Quad.
So I would just like to add on that is, see, the semiconductor manufacturing is a very high precision game, right? We are talking about 5 nanometers, right? So that at that particular dimension, even a dust particle can actually just destroy your circuitry. So you need very high precision, clean environments and all that. And true to their reputation, Japanese companies excel in doing this. And just a few Japanese companies, you know, run this part of the semiconductor industry, right? So there are just three or four companies which are supplying etching gas to the world, just three or four companies which are leading in terms of photoresists and all that, right? So that's why Japan also has a very distinct advantage with respect to semiconductor manufacturing within the Quad. So that's an advantage. Let's come to Australia then. Rohan, what do you think about Australia's strengths?
I think the biggest strength that Australia has in semiconductor, the value chain, is processing raw materials. So semiconductors use a bunch of rare earths to be made possible. And generally what we see here, and I think there's a paper that Pranay and I have been working on, and during the research we found that a lot of the rare earths and materials that are used to manufacture the semiconductors are concentrated in a few parts of the world. For example, phosphorus is concentrated in Morocco and so on and so forth. But companies that process these materials are either in China, which is a pretty big player in the processing department, but the only player that's outside of China and is doing well in the space is Australia. And I think they've got a company whose name I'm sure to butcher, but I'm just going to give it a shot anyway. Lihans Corporation?
Linus.
There you go. So they're the second, they're the biggest manufacturer, the producer of rare earth materials outside of China. And I think that's pretty significant because not a lot of countries actually have this strength. And I think that's going to be pretty significant value add to the Quad.
Yeah, so just to mention that phosphorus, etc., are used in, if you have processes for doping of semiconductors, and these are not rare earths per se, but Australia has a mining industry which provides these materials. Secondly, what I think the more significant advantage of Australia is that it will play an increasing role in the original equipments, finally, where the semiconductors actually go. For example, you will have semiconductors in electric vehicles. But for running an electric vehicle, finally, you will also need electromagnets. And those electromagnets are actually need neodymium, and neodymium is again, Australia is the largest supplier. So finally, when we go to a new tech economy where there will be lots of electric vehicles, etc., you will need some of these materials, the rare earth especially, and Australia has proven excellence in that particular aspect. So that's where Australia's role comes in.
And I think to wrap up, Pranay, I think when we started writing this article, you said that all of these countries have their own comparative advantage, but we also have to look at comparative disadvantage. And the way I look at it is that the US doesn't do, or Australia doesn't do well when it comes to the labor front, but they do well on the rare earth processing and design front. Whereas India can sort of make up for that labor front by having more OSAT factories and more assembly plants. And Japan, for example, may not do so well on that front, but they do well on producing SME, semiconductor manufacturing equipment stuff. So I feel like that's a pretty important point, because it's basically this set of countries that does really well to complement each other's comparative disadvantages as well. And this is sort of also what makes the Quad pretty ideal for pursuing a strategy such as this.
Right. The key point is also that one missing element in all this is that, of course, none of these countries actually house a below 5-nanometer manufacturing plant. So that's where all the cutting edge semiconductor products are coming out. So, for example, your latest iPhones will have start having 5-nanometer and below processor chips designed at that level. So none of the companies in these countries have such a fab. Only TSMC and Samsung in Taiwan and South Korea respectively are the players remaining here. So I guess one very important thing the Quad countries can get together and to demonstrate that they are serious about technology collaboration in general is to start a consortium to fund such a semiconductor fab. You know, so already we see TSMC's 5-nanometer plant, which is going to start in Arizona, it costs around $12 billion. So that's quite a significant upfront capital investment. And it would be really big investment for a country like India or even Japan and Australia to do on their own. But if they do this together, I think there is a lot of scope. So that's one really important point that the four countries can get together on. Moreover, one thing we also discussed is that these are just potentials that the four countries has. But to actually really convert it into ground level action, there needs to be a lot more things done on the trade front as well. For example, when we were talking about human capital, if there is all the four countries encourage the movement of skilled professionals in the semiconductor industry between these four countries, or they build confidence in each other's judicial settlement mechanisms, they think of developing common standards, or even the most important part is allowing knowledge transfer on sophisticated technology issues, right? You don't want countries blocking access to, you know, R&D facilities. Say a US company wants to build a facility in India and the government blocks it, saying that this is critical technology and we don't want it to go outside our own borders. So if those are some of the constraints between these four countries, if they agree that knowledge transfer should be easy and there will be freer movement of professionals in these four countries, then the progress of the semiconductor industry can be fastened, and that will be really useful. So our colleague Nitin Pai has called these building bubbles of trust, basically building these bubbles of trust between important countries which think on similar lines. And if these bubbles are handled carefully and quickly, then we can make a lot of progress on this front, right? So this is another thing that needs to fall in place to convert the potential into ground level action.
I think that's a pretty great idea, Pranay. And I think we've... The bubbles of trust thing is really interesting because it's, as Nitin mentions in his op-ed, it's going to be hard to manage these bubbles. And I think we also began our op-ed saying that it's there is some dissonance in strategies of different countries and how they tackle tech. So it's going to be an interesting space for sure going forward, and time will tell how it develops.
All right. Thank you guys so much. This was a very interesting conversation. It was an interesting peek behind the hood of the complexities that go into manufacturing so many of our everyday consumer electronics. And I think there's a lot of interesting points there that India can potentially take away. And I can see that there are a lot of things that India could benefit from doing if it were to indulge in a broader quad technology co-development sort of regime. On that note, I would really recommend all of our listeners to check out Pranay and Rohan's op-ed in Hindustan Times. You should find a link in the description, and also subscribe to Rohan's newsletter. And thank you both for joining me, and thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
Please consider signing up for Takshashila's courses. Applications are now open and you can apply at www.takshashila.org.in/courses.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.